It's Monday, December 10th, 2012, and you're listening to episode 285 of Fear of the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 57 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
My name is Julia.
My name is John.
First item of business, we need to announce our winner for the Postcards from the Dungeon contest. And let me stress that this is just the first round winner. So what that means is the winner that is read on this show, if they contact me, dan@feartheboot.com, even if I'm not real good about answering your emails, I promise I will at least note that this one arrived. So if you email me at dan@feartheboot.com and claim your postcard, then you will get one automatic pick of a game of your choice. And then you will also be added to the poll that will be run across the listeners of our show and then also our affiliate shows, Postcards from the Dungeon, Kicked in the Dice Bags, Players and GM Edition, and the Established Facts. And you listeners will vote to pick the top winner, who will get a bunch of additional RPG picks and then some extra prizes, which include a signed copy of the world's largest dungeon and the, what is it called, the GM's Toolkit or something to that effect? I've suddenly forgotten the name of the book.
Yeah, I think it is called the Game Master's Toolkit.
Okay, so we will link this once again in the show notes. Now, that poll will go up during the week of December 9th. I don't know the exact day because I got to get the winners back from the other podcasts as well and time this out. If it is kind of late in the week, then we will probably push voting back such that it doesn't end until maybe like early January to give you guys a little bit more time to get your votes in. One way or another, the episode you're hearing right now is a late release because we couldn't record this previous Tuesday. So there will be another episode during the week of December 9th, and we will announce the poll going live on that show and provide you with a link. So you don't need to start searching around to see where voting is. Now, the one that we have chosen, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this last name right or not, but I'm just going to pronounce it in the funniest way I can. We have chosen the one from Amanda Plagueman. Now, Plagueman's not how you pronounce your last name. It is now because it's funnier than Plagimon or Plagimon or whatever else you might come up with. If that is you, then contact me. And if you're not sure if that's you, like you've forgotten your name, then you can contact me and ask for clarification. Alrighty, let's get down to it. So we were having a discussion a little bit earlier about a bet that John has won many times over.
Many times.
Because there is something of an urban myth or a great misconception about especially more modern D20 rules.
Indeed. It existed in second edition as well. But in most systems where you have to roll a D20 to hit someone with a weapon, there is a mutual agreement that if you roll a 1, something bad happens. You drop your weapon, you hit yourself, whatever. I regularly defy people to find me that rule in any of the core Player's Handbook and or equivalent RPGs from 2nd edition, 3rd edition, or Pathfinder. While it may be there in optional addenda, it is not in the core rulebooks anywhere, and some people cannot believe that.
The only thing I can vaguely remember, and I will say this with the very strong caveat, I don't remember where I saw it. So it may have been part of second edition standard rules. It may have been something that came from some kind of an add-on or an optional rule set or whatever. Is I thought that if somebody had multiple attacks and they rolled a 1 on one of those attacks, that the string of attacks got neutralized.
I've never even seen that.
I could be wrong on that.
I think I have seen optional critical fail rules in the Tome of Battle in second edition. I know there were a ton of optional critical success charts in that book, but I have not seen in any of the core rule books that I can remember a rule stating that if you're making a full attack and you roll a 1 at any point, the rest of yours are just canceled.
Well, even Pathfinder has a crit deck, and then they also have a fail deck.
They do, but that's not in the core
rules. Yeah, it's not in the core rules.
There's splat aplenty. We're talking about a period of 30 years of splat here to work with. You can find charts from magazines and paperback supplements and stuff. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that. But it's not baked into the game. Mm-hmm. Your heroes do not have a 5% chance of poking themselves in the eye.
Do you wish there was?
No, hell no.
No?
I would be okay with, like, you roll a 1, you roll a 1 again, and then you roll on a chart that has moderately bad stuff on that. And, you know, maybe if you roll double aught on a percentile dice, then you actually hit and hurt yourself. But you're talking about competent, trained fighters all the way through heroes. A round is 6 seconds. Once every 20 rounds, they cut themselves with their own swords. I think not.
I agree.
What is that, every 2 minutes?
No, I agree with you. The way that I've handled it in the past, is I have written my own critical fail chart. And I look at it this way. Let me back up to a comment you made about these being competent trained fighters. You are absolutely correct that these, especially if they're first or second level, are presumed to be well above average competent trained fighters, especially when even the generally trained militiaman in the town is supposed to be a zero level character, maybe a first level if he's really good at what he does.
A warrior, not a fighter.
Now, the one thing that I would add to that, though, however, is if you look at even modern warfare, the number of friendly fire incidents, I'm not going to say it's like all the time, but it's higher than anyone would like it to be. A story that Chad often tells is when his dad was in Vietnam, he saw a guy die on a helicopter. And how it happened was the guy was pulling a bayonet off of his gun and it got kind of stuck. And when it popped free, he put the knife through his own head and killed himself. Right. So the point is, these things do happen. Yes,
they do happen. And they don't happen every 2 minutes.
Precisely. And this is why the way that I've typically handled it in my games, when I choose to use this, and I don't use this in every game, if you roll a D20 and you roll a one, I am now going to go to a second chart that I have created myself. And most of the items on this chart are relatively innocuous. You maybe just fumble and lose that attack. If you have multiple attacks, maybe all of your attacks fail. Maybe you kind of stumble a little bit and now, in addition to missing to the attack, you now lose 2 points off your armor class because you kind of stumbled a bit. Maybe the weapon got kind of stuck in something. All the way up to, if you really botched this second roll on top of the first roll, then it is possible that you could have broken the weapon, hurt yourself, hurt a friend. But these are at the worst end of that chart. This is not the even average outcome within the critical failure.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that happening 1 in 1,000 times, but not 1 in 20.
Yeah, I think I'd cut the difference. I'm not going to say I'd take it all the way to 1 in 1,000, but certainly 1 in 20 is entirely too much.
Yeah.
What do you two think? Because to me, I think it lacks parity, especially if you look at the typical D20 rules from 3.0, 3.5, and I think this carried over to Pathfinder, but I don't know Pathfinder's rules. I do 3.0, 3.5, so John, correct me if I'm wrong. In those two games, if you roll a 20, and then you roll a second 20, and then the third roll is a hit of any kind.
Third roll.
It's second, only the second roll.
Second roll.
Your second roll.
No. Hear me out all the way.
Oh, okay.
If you roll threat range and then a hit, you've done a critical.
Oh.
There is a chance of instant death.
I do not
believe that's baked straight into Pathfinder.
They have a crit deck for Pathfinder.
Right.
And sometimes you can get instant death.
And I'll grab a 3.0 book.
I have seen that. I have seen three crits in a roll somewhere.
It's not three it's two crits and a hit.
So as long as you hit.
So theoretically, and the way I look at it is this. Now, what that means, now granted, if we assume 20 as being the only critical, now obviously this changes if you've got like a 19-20.
Yeah. No. Captain Rapier specialization 14 through 20 range is out there.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he can be like third level if he's done right, especially if he has a keen weapon.
Take some monk levels.
Precisely. Yeah. But if you take just a straight weapon, let's say it has a 20 crit range, then you have a 1 in 400 chance of doing the double 20, plus whatever it would take to get the hit. So let's say maybe you've got a 400, then a 50% chance. So you're talking about, a 1 in 800 chance? Now, if you've got a guy who's got a weapon threat range of a 19 to 20, it's now going to happen 1 in every 100 to 200 times. If you've got somebody who's got the 18 to 20 crits, and then they have improved crits and keen edges and all this crap, then they can do this all the time. But here's the point.
And there are builds. There are mid-level builds built around getting a 15 to 20 crit ratio.
Like I said, I played with one.
Doing nothing but riding that expected value.
But thinking, the point being that you could take a pig sticker and bring down the Elder Worm in one strike. And the way I look at it is if we're going to allow that, which I'm fine with, because quite frankly, I think that adds something to the setting. I think the idea that a regular guy can take a spear, put it through the eye socket of a dragon into the brain and drop him dead,
through a missing scale in your armor.
An arrow and a missing scale.
I mean, this is well established with
You could have a really stupid name for that character, but he would still be a ranger, regardless if he was named after another class.
Bard. Like a class that would do this maybe once every 2 minutes.
Yeah, like a class that should actually hit itself every time it rolls.
Absolutely. So, disbarring bards, I think there is a problem here. But if it was all bards, the bardening,
that's right.
I think that the critical miss range should be increased from, say, 1 to just, say,
17.
But the way I look is, if you've got that kind of possibility, which I am completely in favor of, then there ought to be some kind of a gamble on the other end.
I think it depends on the game you're playing, too. I don't know, it kind of helps RP. If you have a group that doesn't RP very much, it would probably lend itself to that. But I don't know, I definitely think it has to do with
certainly, it's easier to RP around combat where crazy, colossal, wild things happen all the time.
Yeah.
Which I think D20 is supposed to be.
Exactly,
I mean, there's a reason it's not 2D6. It's D20.
Yeah, it's a D20.
A 1 is as likely as a 20 is as likely as 10. It's not something where you're going to get a 7 1 in 6 times.
But I'd have to say, personally, they really suck. Especially in the deck. When you pull something in that deck and it's so awful, and you're like, I have to take this because I pulled it, and it's wrong if I'm like, no, I don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. So
well,
I don't
like
it.
The equalizer. The equalizer is... The stupid kobold can poke you in the eye and kill you, too. And guess what? The more random it is, the worse it is for the PCs, because almost all of the encounters are rigged so the PCs can win. Let's face it. There's a reason that a character that levels up through a campaign faces death, quote unquote, dozens of times and always pulls it out.
Yeah, but I always feel like I do that on my own by rolling terribly anyway. I don't know. I guess that would be okay if you hit all the time. I had somebody who would roll like 10 hits. But only hit on like two of them, or roll 10 times to hit somebody, and only actually hit twice. So
is that person a spellcaster who's on the front line of a 6th level fight with a staff? Because that's supposed to happen.
Well, no, just terrible rollers. I'm just saying in general. You know, I think if you hit easier in a system like that, then yes, I can understand it. But there's a lot of times where I'm like, oh, well, I miss like 5 out of my 10.
You could understand what specifically?
Using like the crit deck and then the fail decks.
Okay.
So what kinds of things are in the crit deck and fail deck?
All kinds of stuff. There's stuff like bleeding, where you can have somebody bleeding for a while. You've got con damage. There's some dex damage. You name it. And it gives a little description of it, too, which helps.
Like con damage really hurts, doesn't it, Brock?
Yeah. Oh.
Mm-hmm. Imagine, if you will, somebody that would take the time and effort to generate, say, random large charts for, oh, I don't know, like a Wand of Wonder. That's what basically the crit deck and the crit,
like.
Yeah. Getting back to that, like your bet, John, and that's what I was thinking is, I believe you, I would want to look at him and see, but I absolutely believe that there was no rule for the critical miss in the core rule of, you
that's
know,
correct.
First, second, third, the good
I don't know
editions.
I don't know about D&D and AD&D, but I know in 2, 3, 3.5, and PF, there
right,
are
yeah,
no
for me, I started with 2. I didn't really start with, I've played some first edition, but not much, but 2, 3, 3.5, etc. I don't think it is, because if it was, you know what, there would be tables for it in the player's handbook.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Because they put tables for everything else. Yep. So they didn't. And what it was is, like you're saying, it's basically, it's the splat. But I'm sure it started in Dragon Magazine. I bet was the first time you ever saw like a critical miss table.
Well, it may have been a role in chainmail. I don't know how far back this goes.
Yeah, exactly. But and I think that's what it is
now.
You've got this bloat, and it went beyond just a critical hit. 20 is a critical, then or the threat range, and you get this. It's like a times 3 damage or whatever. Now we've got to expand on that. We've got to bloat this up, and we've got to make this ridiculous table of you can roll on this and go, and it's just it's gone more and more. And I personally don't like the cards. I've played with the cards once. I know we played some Pathfinder back in the day.
Came out in like 2009
for me back then. I meant like a year ago or whatever, with my other GM in Springfield, and he had the decks and we used them, and we drew out of the decks, and it was like you're saying, it was this weird stuff.
It was really
weird. But he'd always done that too. He made up tables of weird things.
Oh, so this is the same GM that made the 1,000-page Wand of Wonder.
No, it's not the same one.
All right.
Okay.
So I grabbed a 3.0 book, which is the closest thing I have to me. I own first and second edition, and the 3.5, I just use the online stuff, but this is the only one I had near me. And according to the 3.0 DMG, there are both critical hits and critical misses. And the critical hits work. Here's the instant kill variation. I think critical hits are fairly straightforward.
Is this like a shaded box variant rule, or is this?
It is listed as a variant rule. It's in the straight line.
Okay. It is listed as a variant.
Yeah, it's not a sidebar. It does say it's a variant rule. When you or a player rolls a natural 20 on attack roll, a critical roll is made to see if a critical hit is scored. If that critical roll is also a 20, that's considered a threat for an instant kill. Now, a third roll, an instant kill roll, is made. If that roll scores a hit on the target in question, just like a normal critical roll after threat, the target is instantly slain. Creatures immune to critical hits are also immune to instant kills, which instantly is a rule that I don't often enforce either, and I'll explain why in a second.
What's that? Immunity to critical hits?
Yes,
generally?
Immunity to critical hits. I generally don't use it, and I'll explain why.
They abridged it severely between 3.5 and Pathfinder.
Now, the one thing that apparently keeps the rapier nut from taking advantage of this says the instant kill only applies to natural 20s regardless of the threat range of the combatant or weapon.
Oh, that makes it better.
Critical miss. If you want to model the chance that in combat a character could fumble his weapon, that when a player rolls a 1 on his attack roll, make him roll a dexterity check DC 10. If he fails, his character fumbles. Now, this is where it gets a little fuzzy. You need to decide what it means to fumble, but in general, that character should probably lose a turn of activity as he regains his balance, picks up a dropped weapon, clears his head, steadies himself, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me comment on why I am a little bit looser with critical hits than what the rules generally give. The way I see is if a creature genuinely has no weak points, a gelatinous cube, okay, you can't really land a critical hit because what is it you're going after?
It doesn't have a weak point. It's a rock.
But a lot of undead are immune to critical hits.
Yep. But I look
I look at this way. You take the average undead. They're typically made from a corpse. Well, the fact is that corpse needs a certain mechanism in order to operate. If you swing a battle axe and cleave through the spine, the organism's non-functional. There simply isn't enough there for even this magically enchanted thing to work as a functional puppet anymore. And so therefore, I allow critical hits. Golems, same way. I allow critical hits on golems because in my mind, you can strike a weak point in the golem's construction. And a lot of people say, no, you shouldn't be able to do that. But
I can start picking one golem you can do that for and then picking another that you can't. I think I could go down the list and have my favorites and not favorites.
Yeah, I never go the other direction, though. If the rules say they can take critical hits, I let them take critical hits. Where I'll go is the opposite direction of just saying there are some creatures where the rules say they're immune to criticals, and I'm going to ignore that immunity to criticals and allow you to have the critical hits on them. So I always do this in the player's favor based on what, to me, is the morphology of the monster.
Yeah, players really hate rolling their 20, and then you go, it's a zombie, and then they're like, aw.
Yeah, it makes us sad.
I like the feel of critical failure, though. I mean, certainly it sucks when it happens, and I don't want it to ever be any more likely or any worse than critical success is. But I guess to me, that's just part of the gamble. You know, when you choose to do something, it's a risky thing to do.
I think it's a sufficient counter gamble that the kobold is going to critically hit and kill you, which I do allow.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And like I said, with the RPing, it definitely does help with a group that doesn't. I don't know. I play with two different groups. One that even if they miss, end up with this really awesome story about how they missed. So, I mean, I guess if your group isn't talking about how they're doing whenever they're rolling their dice, then it really does help.
So your PCs in that group narrate their own combat responses?
Right.
I should have people do that more. I pick people out to do it once in a blue moon, but there's no reason my players can't all narrate their own
combats. I do that almost all the time. The example that comes to mind that occurred most recently was in our Star Trek game. Carlos playing a half-human, half-Klingon captain. And a full-blooded Klingon challenged her to a duel. And Carlos' stats, quite frankly, were not very good for this. But by the love of the dice, she ended up winning the fight. But every round, I narrated what was happening or had her narrate it. If the guy swung at her, whether he hit or missed, I said, here's what happens. If she swung at him and hit or missed, I said, I want you to tell me what it is you just did to him. And I kept sort of a story flow going to that. You know, and another game that takes kind of an interesting approach to this, and obviously this one's fairly old, is MechWarrior 2nd Edition, where they kind of set up that a critical hit and a critical miss, they don't yield a whole lot of differentiating results on the battlefield, but because of your performance, you learn something from that. Character advancement occurs through a combination of two things. One is these kind of adventure points you just get for showing up. The other is through skill points. Now, you can get skill points in a variety of ways. You can study a skill, you can use a skill, but anytime you either roll boxcars, which is a critical success, or snake eyes, which is a critical failure, it is presumed that you did something so extraordinarily good or so extraordinarily bad that you learned something from the exercise of doing it. You learned what to do or what never to do.
Yeah.
And that actually advances the character.
Yeah, I like that because I had never seen that rule before we played that one campaign.
Well, and how many games?
I thought that was really cool.
How many games reward you from failure? But think about it. In real life, how much have you learned from failure?
Yeah.
Enormous amount.
Exactly. It makes perfect sense.
But games, for some reason, prefer to only reward you for success, not for failure. Yeah. Despite the fact that we as human beings probably learn more from failure than we do from success, or certainly at least an amount in some sort of parity.
Yeah. Well, and I think it depends on your system, because Shadowrun, you can hand out karma left and right. And so, you know, if somebody does something and RPs it very well, even if it's a failure, you can be like, well, you can take 2 karma for that or something. So D&D and Pathfinder don't necessarily lend itself very well to that.
Yeah, and some of the games that use the kind of Benny or chip-based systems, Savage Worlds, Fate, things like that.
Yeah.
If somebody does something, whether good or bad, if your GM is a decent fellow or lady, then they can toss you a chip and say, wow, you really botched that. But it was so funny and so spectacular. Here's a chip. Now, once again, obviously, that's kind of under the purview of the personality of the person that you're running with. But nonetheless, that is an option that the rules allow for. All right. So let's talk about our second thing here tonight, which is obfuscation. There is something that I was bitching to John about earlier that I have experienced in a pretty good number of games. And it has driven me absolutely up the wall.
And now you're pretty gun shy about it.
You
gave me a little bit of sass last night, thinking it was there when it really wasn't.
And I will fully admit that. There was a part of me that kind of, I don't know if it was even thought. Thought may have been in there. It was almost an emotional reaction.
I can tell.
But here's what I mean by obfuscation. Now, I accept that when you play in a role-playing game, there is a plot, hopefully. Now, maybe a plot of your own creation or a plot of the GM's creation or whatever. I don't really care. It's kind of irrelevant to the point here.
There should be some mixture.
But there is a goal that you are trying to accomplish. Now, obviously, if every single goal you set out to do is handed to you, then there's really no point to the game. You might as well just go ahead and declare that you've succeeded and everybody leaves and goes out for beer and bowling because there's really no point to playing this game. And so
although that is an awesome night.
That is bowling. An awesome night. Right. But it's not a good role-playing game.
Yet. I just got an idea.
Yes.
Oh, geez.
So along the way, there have to be things that make life hard for you. Not everything you do is going to succeed. Or even if it does succeed, that does not mean your first success is your ultimate success. Sometimes you're just putting bricks in the wall to get to a house. But one thing that I absolutely cannot freaking stand is when a GM tries to draw out their game, not by plot points, but by improv obfuscation. And what I mean is, for example, you're trying to get the MacGuffin. You're trying to talk to a particular person. You're trying to escape a bad situation. But no matter what you do, it won't work. If you catch the Admiral and put a gun to his head and demand to know everything, well, it turns out it was a hologram or a body doubled. If you catch the MacGuffin and by every freaking right, the MacGuffin was there, you rolled the dice, it's just not the MacGuffin anymore, or it magically disappears. And all this is not the GM doing any pre-planning, but it is simply the game master trying to drag out a result they did not think you would achieve so quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really annoying way to pace a story. It can be used. There should be times when the PCs are tricked or when the PCs go through with their plan and it just doesn't get them what they want. But that cannot beat every single beat of the story.
Right. Now, let me give a counterexample because, John, you said to you this sounded like obfuscation. So I want to hear why you think it was, and I'm going to try and defend why it wasn't.
Okay,
so buckle up because here's a gaming story and I'll try to be as succinct as I can. I was running a Shadowrun game some years back and it had a really intricate plot with a lot of politics and people screwing each other over and all kinds of stuff that I don't really recall. And even if I did, I'm not going to go into because it'd be like 30 minutes to explain. The short version is the group was a bunch of Shadowrunners. Big shock.
No.
Well, you can play other things in Shadowrun. You don't have to be Shadowrunners. I've played great games as corporate guys. But the point being, in this game, they were Shadowrunners. And they were sent out to look into a particular technology that was being produced by a corporation that the guy hiring them used to work for. And this corporation, after they kind of found out that somebody was trying to steal it, made a decision. They said, look, we have our own security, which was good security. Corporations and Shadowrun are very powerful for anyone who's not familiar with the setting. They're, in fact, more powerful than the government. They said, we've got our security. Certainly, we're going to try and do what we can to track these people down and stop them. If they show up here, we've got all kinds of elementals and mages and machine guns and cyborgs that are going to oppose them. But they wanted to hire somebody who sort of knew how to walk in their world, somebody who could hit them where they live. And so I designed this guy who was another Shadowrunner by the name of Cactus Jack. And Cactus Jack was a guy who was from Texas. And he was now in Seattle, which is where this game, I was using the generic setting. I think it was Seattle, at least. This is where the game was taking place. Cactus Jack was given enough budget to hire kind of a group of Shadowrunners to work with him. And his job was to basically meet the Shadowrunners on their own turf. When they're in the Barrens, they're not safe. When they're in their hideouts, he's looking for them. When they're going to their contacts, Cactus Jack may not be far behind them trying to screw with these contacts. Now, he didn't have godlike knowledge. I'm just trying to give you a sense of what he was attempting to accomplish. And he did not always succeed. There came a point where they had been given a series of clues about where one particular MacGuffin, a pretty major MacGuffin, was located. The group worked their way into the corporation, snuck in, got past the security, killed a few people, drug their bodies out of view of the cameras, you know, kind of got down where they needed to be, Deus Ex kind of run through the place, get to the bottom, bust into the vault, and inside of the vault, instead of the MacGuffin, is just a standard straight off the shelf Black & Decker blender, along with a note from Cactus Jack basically saying, I've got you, after which an ambush was sprung on them. And the players at that point were like, what the hell? You seriously just did this to us. At which point, I did not show them all of my notes, but I took the game notes that were in front of me, turned them around, covering up critical parts, but showed them that line and circled it where I had written that right there, the device they were after, and I don't honestly recall what the device was, but the device they were after has been replaced by a blender. And through the entire previous three games, all the clues that they were following had been planted by Cactus Jack, such that they were meant to follow them right into a trap. All right, John, tell me why you feel it's obfuscation, and I'm going to do my best to think why it's not.
You didn't quite frame the disagreement we had in a prior conversation, as I remember.
Yeah, that was a little different. I think that was great. I would have loved that.
As I remember it, my comment was that the fact that it's been swapped out beforehand is written in your notes and is not just off of the top of your head does not make it a categorically different game or narrative device. Meaning, it is obfuscation. It could have been useful. It could have been cool. It sounds like it was well foreshadowed, like it led to a good combat. You did, nevertheless, lead them straight up to the big shiny, make them think it was right in front of their nose, and then poof it out away from them. I think a GM who does this all the time and writes it in his notes is just as obnoxious as a GM who does this all the time and does it off the top of his head. That was my only real point.
I 95% agree with you. And here's the 5% caveat. That's a very specific statistic, Pat.
I know.
I was just saying, I'm
ready for the 5%.
It was actually 94.83%. You know,
I don't quibble with that. I was like, I'm ready for the 5% here.
So here's the 5%. When I've played with GMs who obfuscate off the top of their head, the one thing that pisses me off more than anything is not the fact that they've got the worm on a hook, which they're constantly pulling 6 inches out of my reach. That alone is annoying. And don't get me wrong, John, you were 100% right. Indeed, Pat, 110% right.
No, not 100, just 100.
And I'm not saying it's always wrong to do that, but you did do that.
No, right. And let me follow through on that thought. I agree with you that if that becomes your modus operandi, even as a notes-heavy GM, it is BS. Mm. Now, the one thing where I would say I think it's a little bit different with a notes-heavy GM than an improv GM, generally speaking, and I realize everyone's different, but generally speaking, is as follows. Because it is in the notes, there is a prescripted consistency. And what I mean by that is I have in my notes, he is going to do this to trick them. He is going to do that to trick them. When they get down there, that's what's in there. I did not simply decide that when they got there, oh, they got to the MacGuffin quicker than I intended them to. It's a blender. And Cactus Jack's making fun of you.
I agree that's far worse than a properly foreshadowed twist.
The bigger point here being, because of the fact that it has been set forth in the notes, and because of the fact that I have a consistency to it, I am also allowing that to be broken. Because if I say Cactus Jack puts out a false lead with a particular contact, and somebody in the middle of this says, you know what, I've got another contact who could fact check this, I want to roll. Because it is written in my notes what's going on and I am keeping to my notes, if they make that roll, I'd be like, yeah, it's BS. It's a fake lead. And it would fall apart right there. Whereas the GMs that I am most frustrated by, they're just looking to obfuscate. Right. So no matter what roll you make, no matter what you do, no matter what plan you come up with, it will not work, period. Right. Whereas in my case, yes, you may be getting the runaround, and yes, you may be getting deceived, but the deceivers have had to declare their actions just as plainly as the deceived, and therefore their plans can be foiled just as easily as the deceived.
And I think that's a good thing, but I think a more improvisational GM could achieve the same effect if he were honest with his players and with what was going on.
Yes.
Last night, for most of the thief-tailing stuff that we were doing in our Pathfinder game, I was a little to a lot off of my prepared rails. However, the perception checks that you guys kept making to tail them and not get caught, and, you know, failed, and then see where they're shooting from, and then failed, you could have made those. You could have popped a guy in a dark alley. The problem is, you have a four-party group that's fighter, fighter, divine caster, divine caster. You're supremely unprepared to deal with skullduggery of this nature, and you got beat by thieves. No big deal. That's just how it was. So, relating back to your point, I think there are improv GMs out there who would have said, when they run it by their own independent fact checker, yeah, you run your own, you know, run around this particular guy and you search the Black Ops IRC boards or whatever's in Shadowrun and you find out that it's BS. And then they turn around and say, okay, well, I don't follow that particular chain.
Yeah, and I think an improv GM could do it. And so I'm not bagging on improv GMs here. That's not my beef. What I'm trying to say is that the times I've encountered it, it tends to come from improv GMs for the simple reason they are bound by nothing more, generally speaking, or I guess I should say in my experience, than their whim of the moment. If their whim of the moment is you're not supposed to succeed just yet, then nothing you do will allow success. No. Whereas with a notes heavy GM, there's notes there. They know the path this is supposed to follow and they can see where you can break it and they can be a little more objective. Now, having said that, I do want to stress in all fairness, yes, a reasonable improv GM could make it up as they go and say, well, even though I didn't intend for them to succeed this quickly, and I don't want them to succeed this quickly, but in all fairness, they came up with a great plan. They rolled the dice. They earned it. I'd be a dick not to give it to them. And so they give it to them.
Yeah, I think in my mind, this whole topic that we're talking about, it goes beyond whether or not you're notes heavy or improvisational. I see your points. And yes, I think that one may be more apt to do it than another. Well, I think even if you're a heavy notes GM, you would be just inclined to do that because you've got this all planned out. You've considered everything that you think you have. You've got this and it's going to go out the way it goes. And if...
And then it doesn't.
The players do something completely unexpected, come at you sideways, and they completely circumnavigate your plot, and they get to you. And it's like, what do you do? I think it also relates back to our first topic of I equate that to basically as a GM, you rolled a critical failure. And what do you need to do from it? You need to learn from it, like we talked about right. In the one system. This is the kind of thing that should happen to a GM. The kind of thing that should happen to a GM. Once or very infrequently, you should learn from your mistake to say, oops, my players outsmarted me here. They thought in ways I wasn't thinking of. I need to be better prepared or to roll with that kind of thing. And what you do is when you do roll that failure, you let it happen. You don't be a dick. Like you say, you don't obfuscate. You don't not let them do it. You say, you know what, guys?
Sure.
You came at me.
I don't think it's a failure for the
players. That's awesome. You know, it's
beat the plot
short game. It's like maybe this game's only an hour instead of four this time, but you guys,
Let me give you an example from
and then
history.
You learn from it. You know, you learn as a GM. It's like, okay, I've learned from my mistake. They can do this kind of thing. I need to have more things in the wings to be able to try to throw at them, to challenge them, or try to anticipate what the kind of things
are. Or you need to know enough about your world to be able to improvise for an hour or two and keep it playing.
Move things to other directions. Let me give you an example from history. During World War II, when the Allies set out to get the Enigma machine, yes, it took some effort. But guess what? They got the Enigma machine. And they did not get it 3 days before VE Day. Mm-hmm. They had it for years during World War II. And it's not like if we treat that as a game, they're not supposed to get the Enigma machine, so it's just a fake typewriter. Or right when you show up, the guy blows it up and you can't have it. Right. You know, no, they got it. And that's kind of the way that I approach these games, is yes, I'm going to try and create a plot, but first off, if the players outsmart me, then as far as I'm concerned, because what is a game master? The game master is everyone in the world and everything in the world but the players. So if they have outsmarted me, by extension, in my mind, they have outsmarted the bad guy, and I am not going to steal that success from them. And then secondly, the other thing that I would say is if all your plot consists of is keeping the MacGuffin just out of their reach, that is some sad ass game master.
That was the point. That was the other thing I was going to talk about, because John sort of hit on this with talking about what with what you were saying was still obfuscation, even though it's scripted out and you had it lined out that that's what you wanted to do. I don't have a problem with that at all. If, like you said, Julia, I think that's awesome if you do it that one time. Now, if every adventure of yours is that, then I'm going to shoot you in the face.
Exactly. It's
going to
get old.
Because, you know, it's like, it's cool once, but you don't keep going back to the well.
Well,
you
for a moment, it increases anticipation. Different. 4 hours so, later, you're in the hospital.
Well, and that's because that's
release
the
tension.
You can get that same
rather
way
than later.
An improv GM could do that just as easily. But you know, if it's like if you fall into the rut of as a scripted GM, as a notes heavy GM of, I like doing this to my players. This is the kind of thing I like to run, and you do it over and over again. So that's just as bad.
All right, let me re-up my geek cred here a little bit. Have you guys seen that Star Trek two-parter where they fight the Borg and Picard gets turned into a Borg?
Yes. Okay. The Battle of Wolf 359.
Right. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the scene?
Borg.
I'm glad I don't know that.
Why?
It is the turn of events that leads to Captain Sisko's character arc in Deep Space Nine. Yeah. His entire character arc.
You guys have watched a lot more Star Trek than
also,
I have.
Picard's on and off PTSD, which I thought was more than character traits.
I know you have.
All right, but here's the point. There was a portion of that episode, the second one specifically, where Riker is trying to figure out how to beat this Borg cube now that they have the mind of Picard.
Right.
Because he's like, everything about this ship, everything about the way it functions, everything about the way the crew acts, he knows better than I do. What can I possibly do to beat this man? And Guinan, whose character, they never completely explain exactly what she is, but she's clearly some kind of
she's Doctor Who.
Telepathic Doctor Who thing, whatever. She comes up and basically says, look, if you want to beat him, you've got to throw out everything he ever did and start making your own way. And that's the way that I treated Cactus Jack, is when they got down to the MacGuffin room, and instead of the tech device, whatever it was, they found a blender. That was kind of the message I was sending.
Yeah.
Was, you are now dealing with a man who operates like you do, who is clever, who is canny, who is tapped into your networks. I mean, he's not godlike. He doesn't know everything. But this is a man who is playing by your methods and at your level. Yep. If you want to beat this guy, it's time to go off the script of the generic Shadowrun, and you've got to outsmart him. And if memory serves, they eventually did. Mm-hmm. They eventually did outsmart him. They eventually did kill him. And they eventually did get the MacGuffin.
Thank you for letting him die.
Yes,
please. Oh, that's the worst. We've talked about this before, but the worst
is when they never die.
Yeah, you've got the Mary Sue character, the Mary Sue bad guy.
Baron Von Badass. That's where it came from.
Not only can they not fail, you can't kill them.
Baron Von Badass doesn't have to die, but he does have to be able to lose the
bad guy, and somehow it wouldn't have killed him.
Getting beheaded is what he wanted.
Yes.
He only made
me stronger.
By beheading me. Have completed my plans.
Oh my god.
That's where Baron Von Badass came from.
I know.
That was a slang term I started using in the mid-1990s to describe one NPC in particular, by one game master in particular, who's never been affiliated with this show, but nonetheless, be nice, I won't name the person.
Yep.
But the point is that that's where I started using the phrase Baron Von Badass, because it was like, this is just getting ridiculous.
Yeah.
No matter what I do, this guy wins. Either I can't touch him, or if I do touch him somehow, that's what he wanted anyway.
You've got to let go. You've got to let that character go. Because you can always make another one.
Yeah, there's a real big monster manual.
Well, not even character, even the MacGuffin. You just got to let it go.
Yeah.
Let
the character. Quite frankly, if your plot is so shallow it is tied to one character, one MacGuffin, you need a better plot. And similarly, if you care about one character, one MacGuffin so much that you don't want it affected in any way except how you've scripted, write a novella. Run a role-playing game.
And I was going to say, I feel like sometimes when you do have people who do that a lot in a game, it's because they are writing their game like a movie.
Yeah, like I hate the hell out of that.
Yeah, you like watch, what is that movie with Robert Downey Jr.? Sherlock Holmes is like that.
Okay.
Like really bad.
Sherlock Holmes, original film starring invented by Robert Downey Jr.
No, I know, I just couldn't come up with it. That's what I was equating it to. No, but those movies are exactly like that, where he's just chasing the same thing through the whole movie. And that's how I feel like some GMs write their stuff, is like that. And so the characters never get to it because they feel like they have to keep doing that over and over and over again to keep it interesting.
I don't have a problem with a MacGuffin at the end of the plot. I have a problem with Lucy holding the football. I think that's what we're talking about.
Well, right. And I think that's the thing.
That's a good way of putting
it. Perfect. That is awesome, John. That Lucy, she's such a bitch. God damn. That's just once.
Nope.
I wanted him. No.
That whole comic is a meditation on the futility of life.
I mean, come on.
I hate that comic.
You know what? Just the football. Kick her in the fucking face.
Okay. Lucy or Toshoes? Which do you hate more?
Oh, God.
I'd have to go with Lucy, man.
Yeah, oh, Lucy by far. Bitch.
Probably Lucy. Because
at least Toshoes will come and go.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, that is true.
Lucy was a fixture of pop culture for decades.
Peanuts is going to be reprinted for decades, and it's been around for decades.
Yeah, I'd like to also go on record saying the one person on the internet who does not feel like, oh, I'm so sad Charles Schulz died. No, I am sad Charles Schulz died. I'm not celebrating that. But after his death, everyone's like, oh, I'll miss that comic because Charlie Brown is just like me.
No,
Charlie Brown is not like me. I feel bad for the guy, and I get the humor of the comic, particularly in its early days. But it was funny, and
I don't get it.
Have you read some of the really early stuff?
No,
should
and read it in the context of the time period too. Because like my grandma,
that's
loves
true.
It.
Garfield was the same way. Ugh. You read the first 10 Garfield collections; they were flipping hilarious.
Yeah,
you read it today, it's pretty freaking boring.
Well Peanuts hasn't been so Peanuts old. Hadn't been freshly written for quite some time.
2,000 or 3,000 years.
All those were just, they've been reprinted. They'd been reprinted.
Right. But John, getting back to your point.
Yeah, what were we talking about?
To me, the structure of a plot, if I am going for a single arc plot, presuming it's not a multi-arc plot. So if the plot is, you have to throw the ring in the volcano to save the world.
I've heard that somewhere before.
I can't remember it's who wrote that.
Yeah, some dude.
I think it was Charles Schulz. It was,
probably. But it may have been Gasoline Alley.
If the arc of your story basically is singular in nature, then I think what you have to do as a game master is break it down into successes they can have along the way.
Sure.
Okay, you can't chuck the ring into the volcano, but when the book starts out, and I realize I'm butchering Lord of the Rings here, but just bear with me for sake of a metaphor. When it starts out, one of the Nazgul has it, and they're trying to get it away from you. You kill the Nazgul and get the ring. Now, it ain't in the volcano, but you have accomplished something. It's not like you as a player. It's not a fake ring. They don't teleport it away at the last minute. The first time you go to sleep, someone doesn't steal it out from under your pillow. You have it. You had a success. You earned, and you get to keep. And then we move on to the next challenge, and the next challenge, and the next challenge, until eventually the ring is in the volcano. Now, having said that, my preferred way to write a plot is to have a little bit more of a multi-arc, where it's like, okay, this world has several problems. Sauron is one of the problems, but you've also got to do this and do that and make peace over here.
And that's how Lord of the Rings actually is. They clipped a lot of Saruman's bastardry from the film versions.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
there's a lot going on.
There are threats and powers that exist independently of, and even in opposition to Sauron, that are also evil, that also harm the player characters and the people they love.
Yeah. And
the player characters, the main characters.
Player characters, right. Okay, you might as well call them player characters. Lord of the Rings is pretty much based on D&D.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious that J.R.R. Tolkien was like stealing Gary Gygax's from that magazines.
It's a word that rhymes with joke. I'll let you mull over what that word might be.
it's sad that there are people
that really would believe that. Because, I know.
Well, of course.
Well, I saw the same thing.
Of course, the D&D, because Lord of the Rings was just made, 5 years ago?
Yeah, it just came out like 10 years ago.
They made that movie 10 years ago.
I saw the same.
It wasn't a story before then.
The D&D movie came out before Fellowship of the Ring. It's just a copy off of that.
Totally.
Do you guys read any of the fan reviews in particular? Well, I say fan reviews, the viewer reviews of John Carter?
No, I haven't.
Mind you, John Carter was written like turn of the century.
Yeah. But the last century.
Yeah, the last century. But everyone's talking about how it totally rips off Star Wars and totally rips off. Except never mind the fact that it created
that
style of storytelling.
When you're going to have an opinion on something,
learn about it.
Educate yourself first, please. Just a modicum of research.
I mean, holy crap. The author of the book is one of the main characters, even in the movie. Can you just Google his damn name?
No. So-and-so said so that's the way it is.
40K ripped off StarCraft so bad.
Yeah, totally did. The Tyranid are a complete ripoff of the Zerg.
Warhammer Fantasy is a ripoff of WoW.
God damn that, Lucy.
I don't get it. They're all unhappy. None of them ever succeed. Nothing is funny. I don't understand why everyone loves that comic.
It's the time frame. I mean, it's basically 1940s, 50s. Was when it was his heyday. it's the culture of that era.
Were they all just like, oh gosh, I love rubbing my nose in the fact that detachment is suffering.
And actually, it wasn't that everyone failed. It was only Charlie Brown was the one that failed.
No. What's her name? Could never.
Everyone had a crush on everyone who didn't like them.
They had their. But Charlie Brown was the Walter Mitty type of a character. He can't succeed. Now,
but who in that story did succeed? I mean, hell, the adults could even talk.
Well, no, but
they failed at everything. Not to get too deeply into it,
but you know,
I've had psychological training to make Wayne sound like that whenever he's on the microphone. Wayne, what do you think about?
No, but no one failed like Charlie Brown did. I mean, everybody else, they didn't really harp on the failures of it, really, but they did with Charlie Brown. So for me, I don't like the Charlie Brown story as much. For me, it's Snoopy. I love Snoopy and Woodstock. Snoopy, I would say,
Snoopy sucks. He can't get past the second line of his novel.
Well, on top
all
of that,
he wants to do is write a book, and he can't.
All of his imaginations about being a World War I flying ace, and every one of them, he gets shot down. He never beats the Red Baron. Is there anybody in that story who succeeds consistently in a meaningful way?
Woodstock, because he doesn't try anything.
Yeah, but he always ends up splattered whenever Snoopy crashes a sled or whatever. I mean, he's just like a victim.
He's a victim of Snoopy.
That's what you are. You're either a passive victim of life's turbulence or you try and you fail.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Charlie Brown universe.
I think it is definitely a sentimental thing. Like, it reminds me of my grandmother. So I enjoy them. I don't read them for entertainment.
Your grandmother was a complete failure at everything she attempted?
No, she just liked Charlie Brown.
It reminds me of peanuts. Skipping past everything else, reading Calvin and Hobbes, and then throwing out the entire newspaper.
Yeah, I think I might agree with you on that one a little bit.
So to close this one out, I got to rant about something here a little bit, just because...
Lucy?
No.
Just saying.
I don't need a BP more than I already do. I want to rant about a very unusual difficulty I'm having.
They make pills for that.
You should take a long, slow bath and put some mood lighting on.
Mm-hmm. One of the traditions that my family has, and I don't know if I've mentioned it on the show or not. I know everyone sitting around the table knows about it. But one of the things that my family does, actually both parts of my family and now my in-laws do as well. Carla won them over to it after seeing how well it works in my birth family, is every year at Christmas time, we go onto a website that Carla created, which is nouglysweaters.net. I'll put that in the show notes if anyone's interested.
Everyone DDoS it.
But what you can do is you can go on there and you can put up items that you want in a sort of wish list. And you can rank them from 1 to 5, you know, based on how much you want them. 5 being I want it the most, 1 being I want it the least. And then people can go on there and say, oh, well, this is what so-and-so wants. And they can mark it off as purchased. And they can send you anonymous questions about the item if they don't get what you're after and all this kind of stuff. Now, the great thing about this wish list is it guarantees 2 things. One, you know what the person wants. You don't have to sit there slamming your head on a keyboard or wandering aimlessly around Walgreens on Christmas Eve trying to figure out what it is this person wants. And secondly, you also know that as the recipient, you're going to get gifts you want. I have not had to return a Christmas gift in years or throw one away. I was typically too lazy to return them, but I have not thrown away or returned a Christmas gift in years because of the fact that I know I'm getting what I want. Okay, now, that's a pretty straightforward idea. Here's my bitch. When I was filling out mine this year, I really freaking struggled. Now, I struggled most years just because being an adult with some amount of disposable income, most of the things that I want, either A, I've already bought for myself, or B, are so expensive, I can't fairly ask anyone else to buy it for me. But
I want a long weekend in Vegas. Thanks, random cousin.
Yeah, precisely. Or I'd like that new video gaming system that's coming out this year.
Yeah, I want a Wii U and two full controllers with the TV in it.
Yeah, plus in the advanced controllers and everything else. You're talking like by the time you're done, somewhere around $1,000 of total expenditure. But here's the point. So usually how I fill out that list is I look at things that are coming out around the holiday times. Mm-hmm. And typically, there's a lot of stuff that gets dropped right around Christmas for this exact purpose. Yep. So people like me can say, hey, mom, hey, sister, hey, wife, hey, brother, hey, whatever. Could you go out and get me a copy of blah, 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 which is dropping in early December, late November, and get it for me as a Christmas present? And I'll just lay off buying it myself because I don't need to play it right this second. And when I went out this year and started looking for things to buy, I don't know if this is just a series of bad coincidences. Every video game I want, and video games in particular, are all slated to come out in March of next year. Dead Space 3, March of next year. Tomb Raider, March of next year. The South Park comedy RPG, March of next year. And I don't remember all of them. I had tons of these. Some of them I listed on my Christmas list. I don't remember all the titles. But I found like a half dozen video game titles. And that all looked really badass, or at least, well, interesting enough that I would play through them. And every single one of them was on a pre-order until spring of next year.
Yeah.
Do you know, you want my opinion on this? I think it has to do with the streaming. People don't buy those as Christmas presents as much, because a lot of people just buy it off their PlayStation or buy it off the Xbox. Just
But you can do that for a present.
Yeah,
Gabe Newell has had a quarter of every present my brother and I have bought for the last 5 years for each other.
Would your mom be able to do that for you?
No.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Good. Well, yeah, but not all parents. What I'm saying is not everybody can do
that. Well, here's the thing. Let me give you another example. A couple years back, when I was playing through Fallout 3, I wanted all of its expansions. Mm-hmm. And some of them were good, some of them were real lemons. But nonetheless, I wanted its expansions. I was able to go out and find game codes where you could walk into Best Buy and you could buy something that's about the size of a DVD case. And all that was in there was just a code where I could go onto Xbox Live, type in this code, and it would download the expansion. Mm. And this was something that I could put on my list. And even though it was completely digital, my mom could still walk into a Best Buy, or one of my siblings could go onto Amazon and order this item and gift wrap it and hand it to me.
Yeah,
they didn't have to create a Steam account and then gift me something and count it as a Christmas present.
I just don't think it's advertised that well.
No, and that's true. But something else I would also throw in there is that a lot of games are still coming out on physical media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, okay, like the Minecraft version for the Xbox. Yeah, that's digital. But the upcoming Tomb Raider game, I don't think you can buy digitally, at least not on console. You might be able to on computer, but you have to, as far as I know, you, and I could be wrong, but as far as I saw from looking around, you have to go get physical media. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm sure 6 months after release, it'll be downloadable.
Yeah.
But at release, you have to go get the digital copy, because that's how a lot of the distribution companies make their money.
It's still also a matter of when it's released. Like, my reaction to what you're saying, Dan, is like, that seems like a bad mistake on the game company's part in the fact that they don't have their stuff ready for Christmas, because Christmas is the big holiday.
And
no matter if you're selling something, it doesn't matter what it is. If you sell widgets, you want widgets ready for the holiday season, because people buy things.
Yeah.
People spend a lot of money and you want to have that ready. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of games coming out right now that are out there. They just may not be games that we are interested in. You know, like you said, you've got a lot there coming out later. So I know that there will be some release right now, but it sounds like some of the big names.
Man, I don't know.
They're late. And on the one hand, it sucks because I want it for Christmas. But on the other hand, I'm also like, well, I would rather they take their time and do it right and not release
not release
Mass Effect 3. So you know what I'm saying.
So not Mass Effect 3's ending at any rate.
No, certainly
I will agree with that. I would rather have it right than soon. But you think you take that into account.
Yeah. Because
look, as a programmer, when I estimate out projects, I always pad the deadline for
that. Yeah, because, you know, these are not games they've been working on for like 3 months. These games have been in development for multiple years.
So if someone said to me, we want a Christmas release, and I thought it was going to take me 2 years to do, I would tell them 2 years and 3 months.
Oh, absolutely.
For that exact reason.
Yeah.
So that I could screw it up and not end up in March.
Yeah, I learned that putting together Goblins.
Yeah.
Oh, this can be done in 2 months. 1 year later, it's done.
So that was just kind of baffling to me. But no, even some titles I didn't care about. And I'm trying to remember now. So I may be getting some of these wrong. So I'm just going off the top of my head. But like Far Cry 3. I really wasn't that interested in it, but I was just trying to fill out my list.
Mm-hmm.
March of next year.
Yeah. You know, why March?
Alien Space Marine. March of next year.
Yeah.
I looked at the Final Fantasy.
It's in the first quarter. That's what
Final Fantasy.
That stupid Alien Space Marine game has been delayed for longer than Half-Life 3.
I looked at the Final Fantasy 14 reboot that they're doing, which is getting rave reviews from the people that have previewed it.
Is it really?
Yeah, they are saying that they radically fixed the game.
Well, one would hope.
You know, I have to give them credit, at least for saying, yeah, we screwed up, we're going to pull the game and fix it, as opposed to releasing a DLC that clarifies why bad is good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Borrower.
Casey Hudson did not commit seppuku like the entire Squaresoft management team did, and maybe that's a problem.
So I have to give them credit, at least, for saying, you know what, Final Fantasy XIV was a lemon, they pulled it, they shut it down, and they're redoing it. I think it's called Final Fantasy XIV, A World Reborn, or something to that effect, is the name of the
game. As far as I understand, they actually had an in-game apocalypse, which they're now coming back from.
And I was reading through, which is cool. I was reading through several people that have had hands-on with the new game, which, by the way, is not supposed to be released for like another year, but so maybe I'll get that for Christmas next year. But everyone's saying that like they really did a number on this thing, and the new version looks really cool. Now, as I've said in the past, the only group in the world that makes and breaks promises faster than politicians is MMO makers. Yes. So this could end up sucking, but nonetheless, that's at least worth looking.
I can't wait until Conan comes out.
So you know what I ended up actually mostly asking for this year was just a lot of random kind of gift cards. It's like, oh, hey, I hate GameStop, but GameStop sells Steam gift cards, so give me one of those.
Yeah, and, I have a three-pointed sheet that I have to put into the hat, and I think mine was like Steam gift cards, classy liquor, and a thought-provoking book.
Yeah, and I have a thought-provoking book in there. I have one that's kind of an overview of philosophy.
Oh, I didn't name one. I just said.
I guess I'm really sad because I just took my wifely duties and asked for a crock pot and some like practical things.
This is about to be you and your best friend.
Someone else's not wifely, those wifely duties.
My cooking duties.
You're not even a wife.
I know, but still, I asked for a crock pot and a new toaster.
That is kind of admirable and kind of sad. I haven't decided which.
It's just, I buy myself video games. I don't buy myself a toaster.
Yeah. That's the good part about growing up. Something you really want is like $50. Okay.
Yeah. I'll take it. I've had to keep myself from getting Assassin's Creed 3. Like, I got yelled at from
That's the dark side. You get friends and family going like, don't buy that for a month. And you're like, just get me $50 of Steam credit. I want to play it now.
Yeah, something else will come out eventually. Anyway, so best luck to you who are making out your Christmas list right now. And even better luck to those of you who don't do Christmas lists and just get surprised. Anyway, don't forget to check the show notes. We'll have a couple links in there. And on top of that, with the next episode we drop, which should be this coming week of December 9th, I don't know the exact day, but Wednesday or Thursday or so, because this is a show being released late, we will give you guys a link to the poll. And we should have pictures of the postcards that were selected by each of the shows in our little group. So you guys can vote on that. And the one that wins that will win the bonus prizes. And on top of that, we'll also win the extra 3 picks of RPG products. And if you want it all, if you want even into the first round, you get a free pick of an RPG or similar product. So Amanda Pligman, be sure to get in touch with me somehow and we will work out all the details. Anyway, thank you guys for tuning in. Have a great week and all that stuff. And we will catch you guys shortly.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.